sure that most people, when they think about World War I, the images that come to mind will be images of trench warfare. This morning, we'll be talking about a different aspect of World War I that I'm sure doesn't quite have the same place in the popular imagination that the land war does. We'll be talking about the war at sea, which some people would argue was in fact much more important made a more important contribution or had a more important impact on the ultimate outcome of the war. Our guest for the program today is historian Robert K. Massey. He has authored a new book that's just out now, which is titled Castles of Steel, Britain, Germany, and the Winning of the Great War at Sea. It's published by Random House. It takes its title from a phrase by Winston Churchill, who described the massive battleships as castles of steel. Robert Massey has studied American history at Yale and modern European history at Oxford. He was president of the Authors Guild between 1987 and 1991. He is well known for some very widely read books that he has written about Russia, including Nicholas and Alexandra, a book, Peter the Great, His Life and World, which won the Pulitzer Prize for biography, and also the book The Romanovs, The Final Chapter. And one other book that is, in a sense, a prelude to Castles of Steel, which is titled Dreadnought, Britain, Germany, and the Coming of the Great War. So if you're interested in this period of military history, you should definitely look at those two books, that one and this one. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Massey, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. And may I say something before I start?
Yes, sir.
Thank heavens for public radio and NPR.
Well, that's
very
fine.
Where would we be without it?
We appreciate that. I guess I would say that we are trying to do something a little different than our commercial colleagues. So if we succeed, that's great. And I must say also that I never would have thought so long ago when I read Nicholas and Alexander that I would ever be talking with you. I read that book when I was in high school, and in fact, I still have my copy at home, a rather battered paperback copy of the book. So I'm glad to actually have the chance
to
talk
about it. Well, it's nice to hear that. Thank you.
To talk about Castles of Steel, Britain, in the run-up to World War I, Britain had a long history as a naval power, but Germany didn't. And it was Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was the German leader, who decided that Germany needed to have a powerful navy. Why did he make the decision? Why was it that previously the Germans hadn't really thought about needing a navy, but then he decided that indeed it should?
Well, Mr. Inge, everything you've said is true, except I'm not sure I would use the word needed.
Mm.
Germany did not really need a great navy. Germany, in the center of Europe, needed a great army to preserve its sort of integrity and independence. And once Bismarck had created the German Empire in 1871, Germany was the greatest military and economic power in Europe. They didn't really need a battle fleet. They had the world's second largest merchant marine after Great Britain. There was no challenge to the mercantile activities of this fleet. Germany had come late to the table in terms of getting colonies, but German ships went everywhere. The reason the Germans built a great navy was not because they needed one, but because the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, William, wanted one. And the reason he wanted one, I'll say this quickly, is that he was half British. His grandmother was Queen Victoria. He was the eldest grandchild. His mother was Princess Vicky, a British princess. And he spent a lot of time in England as a child, and he had this powerful love-hate relationship with England. He envied the British. He admired the British fleet. On the other hand, he loved his grandmother, Victoria. But he hated, really, his uncle, Edward VII, whom he thought of as a sort of a strutting popinjay. And he wanted, what he saw was that the British didn't really care about Germany that much. Britain was this great sea power with this world empire, and they didn't really care that much about what happened on the continent. And William wanted to impress them. And while this sounds simplistic and even cliche, it's actually the truth. When he came to the throne, his father, Friedrich, died after only 99 days of throat cancer, and this 29-year-old, psychologically disturbed young man came to the throne, gaining a navy and acquiring sea power was one of his objectives. He couldn't get one for 10 years because while the emperor had the power of peace and war, the Reichstag had the power of appropriating money. It took Willy, as he was called in the family, Willy, 10 years to get a navy minister, Alfred von Tirpitz, to get a navy bill through the Reichstag to start building a fleet to compete with Great Britain. And after that, then the British noticed and began to build. Germany didn't need a navy to conduct itself either as a great economic or military power. The fact that the Kaiser wanted one led to really disastrous results.
Well, that's, I think, an important theme of the book, and that is the relationship between war and peace and military buildup. This issue that the question has been so often asked: Do our armaments make us more secure?
It's one of the things that will never be decided, because there are examples on both sides of arms buildups leading to war and arms buildups deterring war. In the case of the lead up to the First World War, or the Great War, which it was called then. The effect of the German naval building effort was to bring Great Britain out of her century of isolation. Britain was a great sea power in Ireland, wanted to have independence from Europe in terms of entangling alliances. But when the Germans began to build a great navy, the British began to look to their situation in the world. And they reached out and made not alliances, but understandings. They were called ententes with their centuries-old traditional rivals, France and Russia, to balance the growing power of Imperial Germany. And this was an effect of this arms race. The result was that when the war, in that terrible summer of 1914, as the world was sliding and Europe was sliding into war, Britain was dragged in by understanding she had with France, so that the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, felt that Britain couldn't honorably stand aside and let France be overrun. There's a longer story to that, but I don't want to go on and on.
There were, as I see it, it seemed that there were two important figures in at this time in the development of Britain's navy. One of them was Winston Churchill, a name that will be familiar to people, but the other is not a familiar name, a man named Jackie Fisher. Who was Jackie Fisher?
Jackie Fisher was an extraordinary man, and I think there are three chapters about Fisher and two about Churchill in Dreadnought, the earlier book. Jackie Fisher was a poor young boy who came in, as most cadets did in the middle of the 19th century, into the British Navy when he was 12 or 13 years old. Spent his whole life in the Navy, at sea and ashore, first on sailing ships, and then as the sailing ships transformed themselves into iron and steel ships with great long-range cannon and heavy armor. He rose to the top on sheer merit, and also he had a personality which was both winning and upsetting to his enemies, and winning to the people who sort of looked for somebody to shake up the stodgy British Navy, which hadn't fought since Trafalgar in 1804. And Jackie Fisher rose to the top when he got to be first Sea Lord, which is the top naval commander in the British Navy. He instituted this building of brand new, all big gun ships. And they were called dreadnoughts. Dreadnought, fear not. Mm. And the building of dreadnoughts automatically made obsolete all the battleships in all the world's navies, including, just parenthetically, all of the new ships that Teddy Roosevelt had been building for the U.S. Navy. And the Germans started to copy him, and then there began this dreadnought building race in which Britain felt they had to triumph. Being an island, being small army, being vulnerable, Germany having this huge, very efficient army, the British had to maintain supremacy at sea. The Germans took this as a challenge, and you had this race to put more battleships at sea. One of the results was that in 1906, when the new liberal government came in with lots of plans to improve the lot and welfare of the British people, education, old age pension, so forth, they had to cut back and finally eliminate spending on these programs, because every penny and pound was going into the building of dreadnoughts. And the same thing happened in Germany, although the Germans had to maintain this large army, and so in Germany, every mark that went into German dreadnoughts was begrudged ferociously by the German generals, who wanted more artillery.
Let me at this point introduce again our guest. We're talking with Robert Massey. He's an historian. He's authored a new book that's about the naval battles of World War I, Castles of Steel. Also, his earlier book that talks about the buildup of the Navy of Germany and Britain leading into World War I is titled Dreadnought, Britain, Germany, and the Coming of the Great War. So those books really do go together. He's also known for his books about Russia, Nicholas and Alexandra, and Peter the Great, His Life and World, a book that won him the Pulitzer Prize for biography. The new book, Castles of Steel, is published by Random House, so is out now. I'm sure those other books are all still available if you're interested in reading them. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Winston Churchill at this time was the civilian head of the Navy. He was the first Lord of the Admiralty.
Yes.
Was also a member of the first Lord is a member of the cabinet, of the Prime Minister's cabinet. He also was member of Parliament. So in many ways he would have been a more significant person than his rough counterpart, the Secretary of the Navy in the United States.
You're absolutely right.
So but I'm interested in how the leadership of the Navy, particularly the fact that here now we have this very influential, very important civilian, the First Lord, and then there would be the First Sea Lord, who would be the highest ranking naval officer, the highest ranking admiral, who would be beneath the First Lord, and at the same time the most significant officer in the Navy. How it is that how this was structured, how that affected policy making and decisions about what would happen and when it would happen.
An excellent question, and the key question as to Churchill's role at the Admiralty in the First World War. Churchill, we all know, most of us remember, because I was a little boy during the Second World War, Churchill is the great war leader during the Second World War who stood up to Hitler and defied Hitler and with Roosevelt helped to win the war in the West. But people forget that in the First World War, or the Great War, he was already at 39 in this key post. And he was so brilliant in his abilities, in his analytical ability, and in his ability to articulate, that Asquith, the Prime Minister, made him one of the War Cabinet inner members. And so there were only four or five people who were really making decisions. And Churchill was firing off just a screed of memos to the Navy, to everybody. Now, he did have the First Sea Lord, who was the equivalent of the American Chief of Naval Operations, who was supposed to be setting or dealing with the operational side of the Navy at sea. But Churchill took over this responsibility and was sending out operational signals from London, to wireless signals to admirals and captains, do this, go there, etc., which he had no business doing, and which the admirals resented, and which were approved by Asquith, the Prime Minister, as long as things were going well. But then Churchill got involved. It was partly a political and strategic decision, but he got involved in the nitty-gritty operational details of the attempt to try and storm the Dardanelles and break through into the Sea of Marmara up to the Turkish capital of Constantinople, because Turkey had come into the war on the German side, and bombard the capital if necessary and force Turkey out of the war and reopen the lifeline to Russia, which needed the supplies, the ammunition, and so forth, which had come from the West. Churchill wanted to do this. Jackie Fisher, whom we've talked about, said it can't be done. You can't put ships up against forts because forts don't sink. And Churchill said, if we go in there now, if we're resolute and brave, we can do it. And they failed by the thinnest of margins. They had to land troops. By then, both the Turkish army with lots of German advisors and eventually German artillery and ammunition came down into the Gallipoli Peninsula, and there ensued this almost year-long terrible campaign in Gallipoli. Maybe some people have seen the great film done a few years ago about that, when the Australians and New Zealanders were on the beaches and the Turks were on the heights above. And when this failed, Churchill's reputation was in tatters. He was forced to leave the government and actually went off to be a major in the army in the trenches in France. And it took him a long time, many years, to sort of regain the confidence of the of his British political colleagues and of the British public.
On the German side, the person probably who was most responsible for building the German Navy and might have, in a sense, been the man who was the opposite number of Jackie Fisher probably was Admiral von Tirpitz.
Certainly was Admiral von Tirpitz.
Let's talk about him and his role on the German side.
Well, he was exactly like Fisher. Neither Fisher on the in the Royal Navy, the British Navy, or Tirpitz ever commanded in a battle at sea, although Fisher had actually participated in some naval actions when British ships bombarded forts, bombarded Alexandria in Egypt, for example. But Tirpitz was a young fellow from Bavaria. A lot of the German naval officers of that period came from the middle class and came from southern Germany, and not Prussia, because the Prussian aristocrats, the von this and von that, were all in the German army. And they were in this German Navy, came up through the ranks, at least the officer ranks. Tirpitz was a rear admiral when William found him and selected him to and appointed him Navy Minister, which is the equivalent of Secretary of the Navy. And in that role, he had a kind of a political engineering assignment. It was his job to get the money from the Reichstag to build the ships, and he did it very successfully. There was a great propaganda effort. There was a Navy League formed with over a million members throughout Germany. They used to put influential people and school children from all over Germany on trains and take them up to the great naval harbors at Kiel and Wilhelmshaven and to see the dreadnoughts being built and so forth. And this became the most significant war machine ever built, at least in terms of size and visual projection of power, is a great battleship and, I suppose today, a great aircraft carrier. The most destructive, of course, are the nuclear missiles, which we have today, but mostly they're buried in holes in the ground or in submarines at sea. But anyway, this was very, very impressive, and everybody was very excited about this, and the Kaiser was absolutely delighted. They were sort of extravagant version of his bathtub toys. Here was Germany going to sea to gain a world empire. It was called Weltmacht, world power, and part of the sort of what seemed to be the implacable movement of Germany towards greatness. Unfortunately, every German ship that slid down the ways into the water frightened the British, And so the British decided we will build two ships for every one of theirs. That was the arms race. But the two figures, as you've pointed out, who built these two navies, and they, when the war broke out, the British had the first navy in the world, and the Germans had the second, were Jackie Fisher and Alfred von Tirpitz. Mm.
You also, in the book, certainly detail and spend time talking about the various commanders on both sides. And I wonder, to the extent that it may be true that armies and navies take on the personalities of the men who lead them, is it possible to say that the German Navy and the British Navy, in that sense, had a personality?
Yes. There was a split personality in the British Navy. The commander-in-chief of the Grand Fleet, the ultimate sea commander when the war began and for through the Battle of Jutland and some months after that, was Admiral Jellicoe, who was a great technical expert who'd come up sort of step-by-step through. He was a great gunnery expert. He was an administrative expert. And he had a sound sense of the strategic purpose of the British Navy, which was to control the sea so that the British Isles could be supplied, succored by sea, by maritime imports, by cargo ships bringing in food, in wartime bringing in munitions and war materials from the United States and so forth. And to maintain the sea power, it was necessary to be sure that always the British Navy would remain supreme. Churchill recognized this in his famous quote when he said, Jellicoe was the only man on either side who could have lost the war in an afternoon, by which he meant if the Grand Fleet had been defeated in battle by the German High Seas Fleet, then the Germans would have been able to control the surface of the sea, throw a blockade around the British Isles, and starve Britain out. And this would pull out probably the key pillar under the Allied coalition. The other great admiral in the British Navy during the war was David Beatty, who was a very different sort of person. He was not a deep thinker. His career had been meteoric. He'd been promoted rapidly because he was impulsively, perhaps reckless is too strong, but impulsively brave. And he'd been promoted. He was sent to the top of each class when he was lieutenant, when he was captain, and when he was admiral. So by the time the war came along, he was commander of the battle cruisers, which were the fast, very fast, powerful ships which Fisher had built, and which were sort of the cavalry of the fleet. And his modus operandi was to crank everybody up to maximum speed and go at the enemy in a kind of a nautical cavalry charge without really caring very much what the odds were, who was on the other side, and not knowing, this is a key point, that not knowing, neither Jellicoe suspected, Beatty never did, that British ships were built were built inferior to German ships. German construction of warships was far superior. Tirpitz, the builder of the German Navy, said the ship's first duty is to remain afloat. And so he armored his ships heavily. He compartmented them with lots of little compartments, so if the sea came in because of a shell or a torpedo, the water would not get very far in the hull. And this cost him. He had to pay for this defensive quality by giving up the heavier guns and the greater speed which the British had. But at Jutland, when the two fleets engaged, the result of this kind of German superiority in ability to withstand a pounding resulted in Beatty losing three of his great battle cruisers, each one with a home to 1,000 men. Each one blew up in seconds when shells penetrated and fire went into the magazines and the whole thing exploded. And the great quote there, Beatty, his sort of sang-froid, turned to his flag captain, the captain of his flagship, the Lion, and said, "I say, Chatfield, there seems to be something wrong with our bloody ships today," as he looked over his shoulder and saw that the battle cruisers following them were being diminished one by one in huge clouds of smoke. Mm.
That one of the things that I wondered about was how at this point in naval history people assessed relative strength. In the age of sail, what you'd simply do was add up the number of guns you had and the size of the ball that they fired, and you could come up with a number of the total weight of metal that a ship could fire a broadside if you shot off all the guns at once. And so that way you'd decide, well, you weigh up the metal, and whoever had the more metal was more likely in an engagement between two ships to win. In this case, though, that seems much more complicated than just looking at the size of the guns that a particular ship carried.
Well, yeah, but you've put your finger on Churchill's point of view. Churchill, when Jellicoe was saying we've got to be... I'm worried about undersea weapons, which no navy's ever faced before. Those were mines and torpedoes. Churchill would, Jellicoe, writing from Scapa Flow, the great naval base in the north of Scotland in the Orkneys, and Churchill would reply, "Admiral, let me point out to you exactly what you've just said, Mr. Inge. You have a great preponderance in gun power. Your ships have these guns of these calibers. You can fire this weight in metal." He was... harking back to the age of Nelson, when exactly this was the yardstick. But as I said, Jellicoe was worried about suppose the Germans appear, they are inferior in numbers, and we pursue them, and they lead us right over a U-boat trap, or they lead us over a newly laid minefield, which we can't have known about, and our ships start blowing up, not from naval gunfire, but from these undersea weapons. So that by the time this war... See, in this war, everything was new. As you said, the days of sailing ships began, in the Tudor time, in the 16th century, and they didn't change that much for 300 years until... Trafalgar, and only in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, did they start switching to iron and steel and propulsion by burning coal and then oil with propellers, and not wind and sail. And nobody had ever fought one of these great sea battles before with these weapons, and nobody was quite sure how to do it or what the risks were of taking losses. They'd practiced before the war. But they practiced with, the maneuvers were all childish and silly and so forth. Jellicoe was aware of all this. Jellicoe saw his mission as preserving the British Navy to dominate the North Sea and to keep the German high seas fleet at bay. Beatty, an old moral fashion man, saw it as his duty to sink the Germans by sort of going at them come what may. And in my book, I hope fairly examine both and come down on Jellicoe's side as saying, if you have to choose between which was more likely to win the war, or you have to go with Jellicoe. Mm-hmm.
The North Sea was probably the most important battleground for the Germans and the British. There were three very important battles fought there: Heligoland Bight, Dogger Bank, and Jutland, which was the big one, the one that people probably remember as being decisive, although I gather that over the years people continue to argue about who won this battle.
Well, both are right. It was decisive, and people do continue to argue about it. To me, there's no argument. The Germans claimed victory. The Germans ran for home as fast as they could. They realized that they had encountered not a part of the British fleet, which they'd hoped, but the whole British fleet. And Admiral Scheer, the commander-in-chief of the High Seas Fleet, knew that he couldn't stand up to Jellicoe in this kind of an engagement. So he knew if he was still out in the North Sea when the sun came out the next morning, that would be the end of the German fleet. So all night long he rammed his fleet right through the British fleet. There were these engagements, but there was no question as to who. I should say, continuing the German argument, they sank more British ships and they killed more British sailors. They killed twice as many British sailors as the British, as German sailors died. And therefore, they claimed victory. And there were these great celebrations in Berlin, and the Kaiser danced a jig and said, this is the end of the of Trafalgar, the Trafalgar syndrome, and so forth. But the fact is, the British Navy held the battlefield. When the British went home, there were no German ships out of harbor. Jellicoe signaled the Admiralty after he'd taken the fleet back in to refuel. We're ready to go to sea again in 4 hours. The Germans, it's not true to say they never came out again, but they never came out again and met the British fleet. As soon as there was any word, and the Germans had Zeppelins then, sort of dirigibles as scouts, that the British fleet was approaching, again, they would run for it. So there was, in my mind, you know, you can say that Grant lost the last phase of the Civil War because he suffered more casualties than Lee. But Grant took, you know, marched through Virginia, drove Lee into a corner, and Lee surrendered. Who won? The man who lost the most, suffered the greater casualties, or the person who occupied the field and forced the other to surrender?
Hmm. Just, this is backtracking a little bit, but just for people to get a sense of why the North Sea was so important, it's useful to look at a map and realize that there, for the Germans, their major military port was Wilhelmshaven, and for them to get out, out into the Atlantic, there was only two ways to go. One way would be to go through the English Channel. The other way would be to go out the North Sea in that area, considerably wider in between Scotland and Norway. The Channel was easily defended, but the North Sea, that would have been the logical place if you were going to try to get out. That was their link to the outside, and so for that reason, that's why whoever controlled the North Sea, it was extremely important, at least as far as the British strategy was concerned, in keeping the Germans bottled up. And of course, for their part, that was their out to the rest of the world, and that's why the North Sea was such an important theater for the naval battles of the war.
Yes, very well said. And once the main British fleet had bottled up the main German fleet in the North Sea, the British swept the rest of the world's oceans clean of German warships and German merchant ships, so that there absolutely was no German overseas trade. And let me say, the other result of this control of the North Sea was the British ability to throw to blockade all maritime imports into Germany. And eventually, not only into Germany itself, but into neutrals, which then transship cargoes to Germany. And that not only did this cut off any military supplies, but more importantly and more brutally, food. Germany was not a great agricultural nation. Before the war, Germany imported food, and the British blockade brought, as the months and then the years went by, starvation to the people of Germany. By the end of the war, civilians were on a diet of 1,000 calories or less. 750,000 people died of malnutrition or related diseases. People were spending their days, women were spending their days standing in food lines. And this degraded and then finally destroyed German civilian morale. So that although the army at the front was still fed and supplied, the soldiers' mothers and sisters and children and so forth were in terrible condition behind. The other thing that that British naval supremacy on the surface did, and that the British blockade instigated, was the German decision to go to submarine warfare and eventually to unrestricted submarine warfare, which meant that the U-boats, which were sent out into the sea approaches to the British Isles, would torpedo without surfacing, without asking what country, what nationality the ship was or what its cargo was. They torpedoed everybody, including neutrals, including Americans, killing American civilians and merchant seamen, sinking American ships. And this over time brought in the United States. No country was less willing to participate in the First World War than the United States, or than its president Woodrow Wilson, who was elected in 1916 on a platform of "he kept us out of war." But unrestricted U-boat warfare and Germans ignoring repeated American demands that it stop forced the United States to come into the war.
Yeah. Well, interesting that here the argument I think that you make is that you can virtually draw a line from Kaiser Wilhelm's decision to for the reasons you have explained, being probably nothing short of simply his personal pride, his decision to build the German Navy. You can draw a line from that through the threat that it posed to the British and the confrontation between the Germans and the British ability to keep the Germans bottled up, and the Germans' decision that they had no alternative but to go to the submarines, to their decision to indiscriminately attack all shipping, to drawing the United States into the war. You can sort of draw a line between Wilhelm's decision and the ultimate German defeat in the war.
Well, what you've just done is describe the in one sentence or couple of paragraphs the theme of my book. And going back to what you said, the first thing you said was that most people think of the land war as the First World War as being this great slaughterhouse in the trenches. It was that, and. No, and certainly, absolutely, I do not in any way say that the horrors and the slaughter and the sacrifice and the heroism of the men in the trenches on both sides, 2 million French dead, 2 million German dead, 1 million British and Empire dead on the Western Front alone, was in any way irrelevant. It destroyed a generation of European manhood. It inflicted a wound on on European culture, civilization, which took the rest of the century to heal. But all of this slaughter didn't move the lines at all. A few miles here, a few miles there. German offensives, Anglo-French offensives, up over the top, and the machine guns chatter, and wave after wave, they die in front of their own trenches. This didn't win the war. What I'm saying is that there's a factor which is less generally recognized and accorded importance is the sea war, which while the generations of young men and not so young men were being slaughtered, was choking and stifling Germany. And then when the Germans retaliated, as you just said, by unleashing the U-boats, they brought in the Americans. And there's an interesting thing here. The Kaiser was very reluctant to do this, but he had turned basically the direction of the war over to two generals, Hindenburg and Ludendorff, and they said, we must use the U-boats. And the chief of the German naval staff promised the Kaiser, before the U-boats were unleashed, that not one American soldier will set foot in Europe. The U-boats will prevent this. And by the end of the war, which was only 18 months after we came in, there were 2 million American soldiers in France and 2 million more in America training to come to France. And this tidal wave of young Americans convinced the German generals they couldn't win, and they told the Kaiser and, you know, the rest. Mm-hmm. He fled to Holland, abdicated, and for better, we the Allies won, but then we blew it.
You mean after the war?
After the war, yeah. when they imposed this punitive peace on Germany, building in the German people, and when Wilson was defeated, his effort to have America remain a participant by defeating the League of Nations. We've created the ground out of bitterness, revenge, anger in Germany, which gave Hitler his launching pad.
Yeah, and then we go on to World War II.
Yeah.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Robert K. Massey. He's an historian. He's authored a new book about the naval battles of World War I, which is titled Castles of Steel, Britain, Germany, and the Winning of the Great War at Sea. And it's published by Random House. And it's a follow-up to an earlier book that talks about the military buildup, the naval buildup approaching the war. That book titled Dreadnought, Britain, Germany, and the Coming of the Great War. And perhaps you also may know him for some of the books he's written about Russia, including Nicholas and Alexandra and Peter the Great, His Life and World, a book for which he won a Pulitzer Prize. Questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes or less than 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We talked about the significance of the North Sea. There were several important battles fought there, including Jutland, the most important one. There were also other battles fought in Europe. One of the other places there was a war fought, and I think it was sort of unlikely just because it was a long way away, was the Falklands.
Yes, that I thought was absolutely fascinating. In the first years of the 20th century, in fact, just before, Germany had established a naval base in China. Remember that the Western powers were all grabbing pieces of China in those days, and Germany did that. And had a cruiser squadron in North China, and when the war began, and I should say that the Germans didn't really expect the British to come in, so they hadn't really disposed this cruiser squadron. And when the war began, and the British, French, and Russians, and then a few weeks later when the Japanese came in, this German squadron was totally outnumbered. And the decision of the commander, Admiral von Spee, Graf Spee, decided to take his ships all the way across the Pacific Ocean from the coast of China, and he went southeast, and he wound up off the coast of Chile, where he was able to get coal, and he defeated an inferior British squadron sent around to meet him, sank them, just absolutely obliterated them, annihilated them. And then he came around the Cape Horn and was met at the Falkland Islands by another British squadron, this time more powerful than his, at the Falkland Islands, which we remember as being the site of the Margaret Thatcher War about 25 years ago. Here, as you just said, in this absolutely distant and desolate corner of the world, I've been there, and it is quite desolate. There was this another battle, in which the British turned the tables on the Germans and annihilated the Germans. Again, sea power in land battles, it's very hard to destroy your enemy in an afternoon. At sea, with heavier guns and more powerful shells and I guess more ships, you can sink the enemy in one day, and that's what happened in the Falklands.
We have several callers here, and I'm afraid I don't have time to get all of them. I guess we can try to get one or two. We'll start here with someone on a cell phone who's calling our toll free line 4. Hello.
Yes, I would like you to comment on the billions of dollars of trade that was between the United States and England during this period of time, and how during the war that the trade between the Germans and their allies had diminished to nothing, and that the amount of money that they had to get into the war because of the fact that they would be losing all this if the Germans should win this war, as a factor of us getting into the war. Thank you.
All right. Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. I faded in and out, but I think I got it. It's true that the American industry was profiting enormously, and agriculture, by trading with Britain. And, of course, our policy was, I think it was the same in the Second World War, we'll trade with anybody who wants to come and get it. And given the fact that the British Navy controlled the seas, the Germans couldn't come and get it, so that was kind of a moot. And there was a very strong interventionist element in the east coast of the United States, where the people who were trading with Britain and sending stuff to Britain and making a great deal of money, were anxious to continue doing that. The Germans simply couldn't respond. We didn't, however. The other half of the caller's question, I don't agree with. We didn't go into the war because we wanted to make sure that Britain would win so we could collect the money. We went into the war very, very reluctantly because the Germans were, we believed in freedom of the seas. The Germans were torpedoing our ships and killing our people. And as I said, Woodrow Wilson went in reluctantly. The Germans, you remember, also promised as one of the most foolish diplomatic promises in history, promised the Mexican government that if they would join in a war with the United States, join Germany, Germany would see that Mexico got back Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and most of California. And this signal was intercepted by the British Admiralty, decoded and passed to the Americans, and then published in the newspapers in the U.S. After that, that and submarine warfare were the reason we came into the war, not commerce.
Yeah, well, the pivotal event certainly would have to have been the sinking of the Lusitania.
Well, yeah, but that was that was almost 2 years before we came into the war. What that did was simply greatly enhance the efforts of British propaganda to say that the Germans were sinking a passenger ship. It was a British ship. Germans argued that Americans shouldn't have been on it. That was an argument. But they sank this passenger ship as it was coming up into the Irish Sea. 1,000 people drowned, 128 Americans. And what this did was to support the British statement that the Germans were, the word they used was Huns.
Well, we are going to have to leave it at that with much more could be said because we have exhausted our time. But certainly for people who are interested in reading the story, look for these two books that we have mentioned. You might want to first read Dreadnought and then Castles of Steel. That's the new one. It's published by Random House by our guest, Robert Massey. You might also go back and read Nicholas and Alexandra. I thought it was a pretty good book some time ago, but still available. Mr. Massey, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Andrew.
We appreciate it.